Good morning. My name is Zach Longsdorf. I represent the appellant Jermaine Stansberry. From Mr. Stansberry's perspective, the most important issue before the court today is whether the district court abused its discretion when it held that his claims were untimely and he was unable to satisfy the newly discovered evidence exception to have the merits of his claim addressed. If, as Mr. Stansberry contends, the record does not conclusively show that he's entitled to relief, then we believe this matter should be remanded for an evidentiary hearing where Mr. Stansberry has the opportunity to present evidence in support of his claims. Now, at this point in the proceeding, before an evidentiary hearing was held, Mr. Stansberry's obligation to have his case heard on the merits is to allege the existence of newly discovered evidence that would prove innocence by clear and convincing evidence. The district court looked at those five factors and concluded that Mr. Stansberry could satisfy only the first element, which is that the evidence was new because he didn't have the Horton affidavit at the time of his direct appeal or at an earlier time.
So could we just stop there? Because I must say that's the first thing that troubled me with your case and kind of the fundamental thing. Because Mr. Stansberry was there, according to the affidavit, for the conversation in the jail in 2003. How is this conversation newly discovered? I mean, so you have an affidavit talking about it, but he was there. He knew it.
He was aware of that, and I think really that this probably goes more toward due diligence because the district court, I believe, was correct in asserting that he didn't have the Horton affidavit, and there really isn't evidence to show that he knew Horton had this information that would support or potentially support a claim. And then the district court really looked at the due diligence and whether Mr. Stansberry exercised due diligence to determine that the claim should fail, in saying that since he was part of the conversation with Hardiman, then I think the district court said that he could have looked at the jail logs or done something like that to see if there were other people around who would overheard it and could provide evidence that would help support his claim.
So is what is new the fact that Horton attested to this or the fact that Stansberry just learned that Horton knew it or overheard it? What's the claim that's new? What's the evidence that's new?
I think both of them are new, but I think what's new in this case is that Mr. Stansberry learned that there was somebody who overheard this conversation and came forward and signed an affidavit and said that I heard this conversation. And what we saw...
So was there record evidence of when Stansberry learned about Horton's overhearing it? Or are we just seeing Horton's affidavit saying I overheard it, which I don't think speaks to when Stansberry learned about it?
Exactly. We don't know when Stansberry learned it, and I think that that's probably something that would have to be addressed at an evidentiary hearing, and I actually don't want to speculate about that, but what we know is that Horton says he overheard it, and then at some point Stansberry learned that Horton had this information, which really I think gets us to whether or not once he learned there's information available upon which he could potentially base a claim, did Mr. Stansberry exercise due diligence in turning that information that he received into something that he could use to make a claim? And I really, when I look at the due diligence part of it, I think that's part of what would have to come out at a hearing. And I think that the record is, there's really nothing in there that says one way or the other how that occurred in this case. And I think that that's something, a fact that would need to be resolved before we could conclusively say that Mr. Stansberry didn't exercise due diligence after he learned that there was somebody who had this kind of information.
Well, it seems like Mr. Stansberry could have produced some evidence on that subject by way of his own affidavit. I didn't know that Horton was there until 2 days ago when I talked to somebody or what have you.
He potentially could have. It wasn't done in this case. It's not part of the record. And I think what it really goes to is a determination of if there was any due diligence. And I just think that the record isn't conclusive in saying that he didn't exercise due diligence in such a way that this claim can be disposed of prior to there being a hearing where we can flush that out and find out what the evidence actually shows.
Couldn't he have produced an affidavit on that due diligence question as well?
He potentially could have, I believe.
But he could have created the need for or a reason for the evidentiary hearing by saying, I didn't know about it until now, and here's why I didn't know about it until now.
I believe that he could have done that. It's not a part of the case, and I would just submit, as far as when we consider this due diligence, Mr. Stansberry was in the holding cell. He's been in prison since then, so really it's hard to say that. I mean, the standard is due diligence, not maximum possible diligence or something like that. And so him being in prison, him potentially not knowing about this person and that this evidence was out there, and at least in our view, would satisfy the requirement of there being due diligence in this case once he learned of something. The district court also said that the evidence was merely impeaching and that it was merely cumulative in this case, but if we look at the facts of the case, which are that this Hardiman was arrested, the officers testified the gun came off from his lap, Hardiman's DNA is on the gun, well, at least it can't be excluded from the mixture that's on the gun, Stansberry's DNA has been excluded, and so when we have Horton saying he overheard Hardiman say, hey, I know it wasn't you, and that if I'm asked, I'm going to carry my weight in this case, I think that where we get to a position where this evidence is only merely impeaching or merely cumulative is by giving it the least possible credit that we can, which I guess is inappropriate in our view before an evidentiary hearing where we get to the credibility determination. And what I mean by that is I think if we look at the facts, which is that Hardiman had the gun in his lap, that his DNA can't be excluded, and that he's picked up, I think one of the officers testified 30 seconds after the incident occurred, and him saying, hey, I know it's not you, and I'll carry my weight on this, I think a reasonable inference that we can make out of that, if we give it credit, is that he's saying that because I know it's not you, because it was me, and I'll carry my weight in this situation because it was, in fact, me that committed this crime, not you. And so we believe that the district court didn't faithfully apply the law regarding whether the evidence was cumulative or impeaching because it didn't look at those inferences that could be possible based on this evidence and instead just said, well, it might impeach a witness or it might support Stansberry's testimony wherein he said it wasn't me and it might support the DNA evidence, which is just cumulative. But I think this evidence, what Horton said, he overheard from Hardiman, if Hardiman attested to that or stood by it or something along those lines, or if it was found to be true for some reason, would support the conclusion that it's more likely that it was Hardiman who committed this crime than it was Stansberry. So I think the evidence has a probative value outside being merely impeaching and merely cumulative when it comes to that. And when the district court didn't consider it that way, we believed it abused its discretion.
How about, and maybe you're turning to this next, the final element of the clear and convincing evidence of innocence? Because a lot of what you're saying is an inference that a jury might have drawn, et cetera.
Well, again, part of this is we haven't had an evidentiary hearing, or so we don't know exactly how this evidence comes in. But I think there's a scenario in this case, if we follow that inference, that he says, yep, I know it wasn't you, and I'll carry my weight. I know carry my weight, as the district court pointed out, isn't the same as him saying, yes, it was me, I did it, I committed this crime, which I think would be completely exonerating. But, you know, that's just not how people talk a lot of times. And when somebody says something like, I'll carry my own weight, to me at least, what I take from that is I'll take responsibility for my own actions, and I won't make you be the one that takes the fall for what I've done. And so if we look at it like that, and if that's the way that this evidence came in, we have a possible alternate perpetrator essentially confessing or saying words that could mean, I did it, I know you didn't do it because I did it, and I will carry my weight because I did it. And if that's what happens, that's how it came in, I think that would satisfy the clear and convincing evidence.
So with the evidentiary hearing, include your envisioning, I'm looking at the affidavit, Lil Cass, is Hardiman, is that
we,
the?
We believe that's Hardiman.
Him testifying as to what he meant when he said that?
I think that would be our ultimate goal, would be to try to get him on the stand and find out what he says and do that. And then, you know, the admissibility of the statement, I guess we don't know exactly how that would come out. If he takes the Fifth and doesn't testify, maybe we could try to get it in as a statement against interest because he's unavailable, but ultimately we would like to present the evidence, which, you know, as Mr. Stansberry, at least as I look at the affidavit, Stansberry is getting ready to go into court, and this guy says, hey, if I'm, you know, called and asked about what happened, I'll carry my own weight. So we'd see if, in fact, he's, what that means, and if it does mean that he comes up and says, yes, it was me, not him, then I think it would satisfy all the requirements of the newly discovered evidence and show his innocence.
Was Hardiman available to be subpoenaed at the time of trial?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. I don't know. My belief, based on my client's affidavit and what he's made part of the record, is that nothing really was done as part of preparation and trial for his case.
Right. I understand that that's sort of a different part of the proceedings here. But if he was available, or if we don't know that he wasn't available, there actually seems like there might have been a tactical reason not to have called him. And that is, the defense presented by Stansberry at trial was to try and create a reasonable doubt on the subject of who had the gun, right?
I think that was part of it.
Right, and if you produce Hardiman and subpoena him into court and he stands in front of the jury and says, I did not shoot that person, I don't know where that gun came from, that actually hurts Stansberry's trial presentation, correct?
I think it could potentially, if that's the way it went, but you know, where we went with the, where Mr. Stansberry believes there was ineffective assistance was that he doesn't think that anything was ever even done to determine what it is Hardiman would say from counsel. And I think part of it is, if we look at the record as this case got close to trial, I think a couple times counsel says something like, well, I'm not getting ready, I think I'm going to get fired or be off the case. And I think that was kind of borne out in that we don't even have any idea whether or not, I mean, we know this is what Hardiman said when he was in the bullpen with all these other guys.
Well, we know that that's what Horton says that he said.
Correct. We know that this is what Horton believes he overheard Hardiman saying, but what we don't know then is whether or not he would have stood by that, and I think the failure to explore that is what was the problem here, and I think, you know, the district court said, well, it's who to call as strategy, and then basically hard stop. Once it's strategy, we're not going to look any further. But
I guess my problem with what you're saying fundamentally is that, well, if this is about due diligence and should he have done more, that was raised, as I read the record, in the post-petition appeal, that his attorney failed to investigate material facts, failed to call material witnesses. And we said in, I think, 2009 that claim lacked merit. So isn't everything you're saying just going back to something that was raised and addressed by this court?
I'm aware that Mr. Stansberry made that argument in a pro se brief, and what he didn't have at the time was any facts to support it. And so once he obtained the facts, that's why we're here today. So I would agree that it was raised, but I think that there are new facts that could change. You know, it's one thing to say, well, I wish my attorney would have investigated and he didn't do anything and I felt like he kind of screwed me over. It's another thing, I think, to have somebody come forward and say, yep, I heard this person, who I think is a viable alternate perpetrator based on what we know, say, I know it wasn't you and I will carry my own weight, and not, you know, so now that he has that to support it, that's why we're bringing the claim. And I understand that it was raised at a previous time, but you know, I have a client who's serving a 306-month sentence, and it appears, at least to me from everything I've reviewed, that this was never explored as part of his trial, and it's important to him. And I think that, at least from my perspective, in the interest of justice, it's something that ought to be explored and developed on the record so that he doesn't continue to serve all this time based on something that he may not have done. Absent any questions, I have no further.
Okay. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use that time.
I May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jordan Rood, and I'm representing the state of Minnesota, the respondent in this matter. This court should affirm this court's decision to summarily deny appellant's post-conviction petition. Counsel stated, and I agree, that the most important issue here is the newly discovered evidence claim.
And do we get to that? I mean, are you incorporating that in? I mean, we don't get even need to get. If this is NAFLA barred, it's NAFLA barred. We don't need to get into the analysis, right? Of that, are you talking about newly discovered evidence as like an exception to the NAFLA bar, or is there a NAFLA bar here? I'm just wondering how we organize this.
Sure.
What's the decision tree here?
So, to the extent that appellant has made a sufficiency claim, that would be NAFLA barred because that could have been raised earlier. To the extent that he raises ineffective assistance of counsel, that's also NAFLA barred because it could have been raised earlier and was raised earlier. Right. Newly discovered evidence is an exception to the timeliness bar, which is slightly different than NAFLA. And so I think generally a newly discovered evidence claim would not be NAFLA barred unless we can say you could have raised this earlier and didn't. And I think that this court could find that here, but I also think that taking it the claim on its merits, it still fails.
Okay.
And so I first want to talk about the due diligence prong. I believe it was Judge Justin pointed out that appellant was present for this conversation. I think that's the key fact here, because appellant is saying, well, I have this new evidence that someone overheard a conversation, but appellant was present for this conversation and participated in this conversation, which means it's not new. He knew about it. He was there. This was in the summer of 2003, according to the affidavit, possibly before or during the trial, and in any event, before he filed his first post-conviction petition in 2007.
But what's new is that apparently Mr. Horton will say that he heard it. And what we don't know from this is whether Mr. Stansbury knew that Horton overheard it. And I think the argument is that something that should be fleshed out in evidentiary hearing, whether, so, you know, for all he knew, Horton never heard any of this, and so he's learned someone else who saw or heard something critical to his case.
That's right, and I would point to, in my brief, I've cited a case, Evans v. State, I believe it's on page 11 of my brief. In that case, the Supreme Court held that evidence is not considered to be newly discovered if the defendant was admittedly present at the time of the events in question. So I think even if he has information that somebody he didn't know had overheard this conversation, the fact that he was there means that it's still not new, because he knew what Hardiman said because he was there. So he could have raised that during his trial, either by, you know, calling Hardiman or in some other way, or he could have raised it on his first post-conviction petition. So I think that's the key fact on this point, is that he was there. So no matter how many people he's found out has heard it later, the fact that he knew about it then means that he should have raised it then and not now.
So one of the things that troubles me the most, and so I just want you to address this for me, because even in looking at the newly discovered evidence issue, we look at what's cumulative, we look at the interests of justice, and the fact that Mr. Stansbury points out that his DNA was not on the gun, but Hardiman's couldn't be excluded. And I didn't see you directly address that in your brief. And when we're looking at, well, is this just cumulative? What does the interest of justice require? That's a fact that troubles me, if that's true. Could you address that for me?
Sure. I would say in addressing this issue that it's most important to look at the evidence that's being offered here. So the actual claim or the statement from Hardiman. Because if the statement itself says, if I'm asked, I'll say that appellant was not the shooter. I don't know, that doesn't add anything that we didn't have at trial. Appellant himself said, I'm not the shooter. And there's no affirmative statement from Hardiman, I was the shooter, or I know who's the shooter, and it's this person.
But don't we have...
Arguably, there is, though. I mean, that gets to the I'll carry my weight or whatever it, the precise words were, that does kind of sound like an admission, or could be construed that way at least.
It could also be construed as, if I'm asked, I'll go up there and I'll do my duty and I'll say it wasn't you. It could also be construed in that way.
Yeah, but the part about carry my weight or whatever, that goes a step further. I mean, if he just said, I would support your testimony that you didn't shoot him, I agree, that's cumulative. But when he goes on to say more than that, then it seems like that might not just be cumulative or impeaching. And I think that gets to Judge Jessen's question.
And I think in that case, then, we can go to the fifth prong and decide whether that statement is sufficient to meet the standard there. And it's that statement by itself is not, because this is a very high bar that appellant has to meet. The clear and convincing evidence must be more likely than not that no reasonable jury would convict. And I think based on this statement alone, that that does not meet that standard.
What if he had actually said, instead of the words that he used, what if he had actually said, I shot the guy?
I think that's a very different situation. I think if you have an affirmative statement from someone who was at the scene and who was discovered near the weapon that I shot him, that's a very powerful statement in that situation, and that would probably be closer or would meet the standard here. But that's not what we have here. We don't have that sort of...
Then maybe it is what we have here, that if we had an evidentiary hearing, maybe that's what he would say he meant by that.
It's possible, but on the face value of the statement that we're provided, which is what the district court has to look at, on the face value of that statement, that's not what we have, and that statement itself is not sufficient to meet the standard.
I do think the statement, though, needs to be read in light of the contexts that are in the other paragraphs there, which is that Stansbury's brought in, he tells Hardiman that he wasn't snitching on him, and then full cast says, didn't really think you were snitching on me, but I heard rumors that you were, and then he says, I'm going to carry my own weight. I mean, you know, in that context, it comes closer, does it not, to him actually being the shooter?
Well, I think if this was a situation where appellant was accusing Hardiman of snitching on him, and then Hardiman was to rebut that and say, no, I'm not snitching, I'll carry my weight and say that it wasn't you, I think that would more closely align with the situation with a more clear statement. But in this case, Hardiman is accusing appellant of snitching, presumably on an unrelated matter, because I don't believe that Hardiman was in jail for the offense here. And so I don't know how that, again, is sufficient to meet the clear and convincing standard. I did want to also state, counsel stated that the phrase carry my weight, he imputes that it could be a possible alternative perpetrator in reference to the fifth prong, and I don't think that a possible alternative perpetrator, I don't think that that is clear and convincing evidence of appellant's innocence in this case.
You keep going back to clear and convincing evidence. Shouldn't we also be looking at whether the post-conviction court had considered the facts alleged in the petition as true and construes them in the light most favorable to petitioner? And I think that is what you'll see our questions kind of reflecting, is if we do that, shouldn't there have been an evidentiary hearing?
I don't believe so, no, because looking at the district court's order, it goes through each prong and it evaluates the affidavit presented and says it fails for this reason, it fails for this reason, it fails for this reason. And in each step, the district court takes the statement as it's provided and considers whether it meets each prong. And so there's the statement about it being, I believe, self-serving hearsay, but that's after the district court has already determined that it doesn't meet these other prongs. So the district court did not abuse its discretion by viewing the statement, going through each of the prongs, determining that it did not meet four of them. And of course, appellant has to meet all five prongs in order to succeed on this claim. Unless there are any further questions?
It appears the panel has none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Longsdorf, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time.
Thank you. I just want to, these last couple questions kind of brought my thought back around that before we're at the stage where an evidentiary hearing has been held, it's my client's burden to allege facts that, if true, would support a petition. And I think the fact that there may be outcomes that wouldn't support it doesn't mean that it's not appropriate to have that kind of hearing and determine what the facts are. And there's the case law that we cited in our brief. It was on page 33, and it talks about how even if it doesn't appear that there would be facts that could support it, that it's appropriate to do that fact-finding before just tossing the claim out. And I think that's basically where we're at here. There are facts and ways this could come in that wouldn't support the petition, and there are, I think, facts and ways that this could come in at a hearing that would support the petition. And because that's the case, I think it would be appropriate to have a hearing to determine those. Thank you.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We'll issue our decision within 90 days, and we thank counsel for your briefing and argument. Actually, a few minutes ahead of the printed schedule, but are counsel here and ready to proceed on the Malik file?
We are.
Being ahead of time makes me
happy. I know it does.
The next matter on the calendar is State versus, is it Malik? Am I pronouncing the name correctly?
Yes.
All right. And you will each have 15 minutes. You can have a seat. You'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you represent just so that we've got that for the recording. Adjust the podium to suit your physique and height, and whenever you're ready, appellant may proceed.